behind it all.
Welcome everybody, I am Medu Singala and this is The Thinking Behind It All, our very first podcast looking at current affairs through socio-political theory. This is a podcast where we will be looking at stories that trended the past week. We're looking at stories that trended in South Africa, stories that trended in the UK, and stories that trended in the United States of America. And with me, I've got my crew. I've got Ndlantla, Isaac,
Sage Cole,
and I've got Ayana. To tell you a little bit about myself, I'm a researcher working in civil society. I graduated at Wits University, a master's degree in applied English language studies. I'm from K1, the only township that matters. Katlehong, that's my hood. I was brought up there, raised there, fell there, cried there, spilled blood there, my tears, sweat, guts, everything. So I'm just gonna give it over to my crew to also introduce themselves. Ndlantla?
Yeah, my name is Ndlantla, as Melusi said. Surname is Mjiako. I'm a student at Wits University doing my postgrad in law. I've got a BA law and politics. Yeah, and I hope I can share my own two cents about all the stories that are coming through the mainstream and trying to filter them through that pan-Africanist, pro-black lens and try to make some meaningful interpretation for our audience to be able to follow political events and all that. I'm South African, born in Gauteng, in a township called Sebokeng. Lived up until I was like 6 years old. Left, went to live in Natuarana. I lived there up until 2010. I moved to Mondi, south of Johannesburg.
Right, Ayana?
Hi, I'm Ayana. I'm an activist. Speak a lot on social media about anti-blackness, misogynoir, specifically, you know, directed at black women. Blindness, seeing as how I'm visually impaired. I'm also a writer and a musician, so very, very outspoken. I'm from Philadelphia, PA, right here in the United States. So,
Philly.
Repping the East Coast, repping Philly.
Alright. Hi, I'm Sage Cole. I'm an activist involved in Black Lives Matter, involved in anti-xenophobia protests. I'm also a womanist, and I talk a lot. I'm from the UK. I'm from West Yorkshire. Repping the middle.
No, don't tell us repping royalty here.
Hey, what up? My name is Isaac. I'm also a Ngala, just like the host. And just like the SA team, I also went to Wits, although I did not graduate. I dropped out in my final year. So I've got a pretty good knowledge base in terms of politics and law. I was a Fuse Must Fall activist.
Because you were a victim.
Hey. Yeah, what do I do? I fight white supremacy for fun. Formative years were made in Jameson Park, Heidelberg. I then went to go live with my aunt and cousin in Yeovil. So we moved to west of Joburg, Roodepoort.
That's pretty much the team. So how we're going to be doing this thing, we intend on looking at the stories that were big in the past week. Our various team members will be talking to us and we'll open it up, have a discussion. It's going to be robust. It's So prepare yourself. It's gonna be jarring. It's gonna be shocking at times. You're gonna wonder as to whether do these people really agree on issues. My point is that the purpose of this podcast is to look at things from a pro-black angle / pan-Africanist perspective. That is what we're about, and that's what we intend on doing. We'll be calling out people who we feel like are not living up to our standards, of course. I mean, people have various interpretations of what these notions mean. As the show progresses and as we discuss stories, you get to understand our ideology better and better. This past week, we had the death of Umamwini Mandela. That was quite a shocking event for many people when Monday afternoon, South African time, it was announced that she had passed. So we'll be discussing that. We will also be discussing what's happening in Israel, including the whole Black Coffee saga. We will be discussing abortion. And of course, how can we not discuss the one and only Msholozi, aka the former president, Jacob Zuma. Stay tuned and enjoy the conversations. You can follow us on our pages, our Facebook page. Just look for The Thinking Behind It All. Drop us comments there. Tell us how much we suck or how much you love us. Follow us on Twitter at TTBIA_. Let's keep the conversations live and let's stay black and let us be proud.
She will be forever remembered as the wife who took those final steps alongside Nelson Mandela on his long walk to freedom. But her life's work was just as full of sacrifice, and it earned her the title Mother of the Nation. Winnie Madikizela was only 22 years old when she married the man whose fate would determine her own. Within 4 years, he was arrested and jailed, while she faced her own ordeal, imprisoned, tortured, and for decades banished to a remote town. She cared for their children and kept his name alive.
I know, and the people of this country know, that Mandela will lead this country to freedom.
Don't drag me! I'm coming! Don't drag me!
She defied the apartheid state with indisputable courage.
I'm aware that a baker walking any minute now and take my life as they have stated.
Amanda! But she was also an advocate of violent resistance and the practice known as necklacing.
We have stones, we have boxes of matches.
Of killing suspected traitors with burning tires. She was accused of ordering the murder of 14-year-old Stompie Maketsi. She stayed out of jail but was convicted of kidnap. And only years later, at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, did she accept any fault.
It is true. Things went horribly wrong. For that, I am deeply sorry.
By then, the strains in the Mandela marriage had reached breaking point. The couple separated, then divorced. Yet at his funeral, Winnie was at his graveside, just as she'd been by his bedside at the end.
He drew his last breath and just rested.
From loyal wife to liability, Winnie Mandela became a divisive, some said dangerous and corrupted figure. But mother of the nation is what they still call her, and she had no regrets.
You wouldn't have the liberation South Africa has today if I hadn't done that. I would do that 100 times more.
Ice, tell us about Winnie. What's going on there?
What sets it off is the New York Times headline, Winnie Madikizela Mandela, a tarnished leader of the SA liberation, dies at 81. You know, Black Twitter is not going to allow anything like that. We've seen them with all Black Lives Matter, Wakanda Forever, Oscars Are So White. So they went on a rampage against any article that failed to recognize her contributions in apartheid. This, of course, sets off the whole buzz. International news are put down, critiqued, shared on social media. As the week develops, we actually get into what tarnished her reputation in terms of a leader. It was mostly around the TRC. The TRC is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It was a commission under the Mandela regime. How it worked is perpetrators of apartheid were given a chance to come and give their side of the story if they had killed victims. And if the commission thought that the families needed to be compensated for that, they were. It was seen as actually an attack on Winnie because of how it played out when she was requested to appear in front of the commission. In fact, you'll find that she was the only ANC member that was called to the Truth and Reconciliation meeting. So it was as if all the violence that was caused round about the 80s was because of Winnie. What the TRC found was that Mama Winnie had ordered one of her bodyguards and also the coach of a team she had formed called the Mandela United Football Club. It was sort of like a mob to protect people against the apartheid regime police and to make sure people weren't just detained or taken away from their families without a reasonable cause. So they would physically fight police, which led to a lot of killings. Now with Stompie Sepe, what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission found out was that he had found out that the main bodyguard, Jerry Richardson, was an informant and was going to tell Winnie about this. And so Jerry, being scared of the repercussions of this, decided to kill the young boy, and Winnie was ultimately blamed for it. Clarity is given in documentaries such as Winnie, the one that just came out in 2018 by Pascal Lamke. There are detailed confessions by people like Vic McPherson, who was head of Stratcom at the time, that the apartheid regime used ways of propaganda and informants to discredit Winnie because she was becoming really powerful. In conclusion, for me, when I started the week, I was very skeptical about Winnie. What I thought is that she was one of the leaders that orchestrated Mandela selling out. In fact, I believe it ran from her right through to democracy as we have it now. But upon a closer inspection, looking at the documentaries, the testimonies given at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I actually found out that she was used as a scapegoat for the violence that was attached to the ANC. The allies removed themselves from the ANC because of Winnie's supposed violence in Soweto. This vilified her so much so it followed her post-apartheid, and she never got the credence she deserves as a politician and as an activist for the struggle.
So I'm going to open it up and just hear comments and questions that the rest of the team might have.
I do have a question. Did she know what the bodyguard had done?
She did know that the boy was killed by the bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
How it was played out was that it was Winnie that ordered. This was the narrative that was given throughout the 80s. We only got clarity during the Truth and Reconciliation, which happened mm-hmm. around about 1997, like, you know, 3 years after the advent of democracy in South Africa.
Sage Cole.
My question to you, as someone who's living outside the country, who's not embedded or finds themselves within the pool of news around Mama Winnie, I want to know, what were your initial thoughts when you saw these headlines and reading these articles from a UK perspective and as a black woman?
Well, over here, the way that Winnie is portrayed is, you know, she's this amoral, violent person who killed a child, and Mandela is like almost a light side to her dark. So it's almost like white people want us to be like Mandela and not like Winnie. But what I found was like really interesting is, you know, what kind of people would use a child as an informant, knowing how turbulent politics was at that time, it's really surprising that they would pick someone who's so innocent to do their bidding in something that's such a violent situation. It kind of surprised me.
That is the jarring point about this whole story, is it not? The fact that there's a child involved, and more importantly, the murder of a child, it's what actually upsets people. You know, however you look at it, whether it's for a righteous cause or not. But the fact that a child died and the details around it are so sketchy, yet it's believed that so many people do know exactly what actually happened to this child. It's quite upsetting, is it not?
Was this common that they would pick children to use for information and to kind of bully into giving away things that they don't really have any autonomy of consent in?
When Winnie moved back into Soweto and she started this football team, she also looked after orphans within Soweto, starting feeding schemes, and she really did care for these orphans. And it's just sad that what that coach, Jerry Richardson, did, he was the one that was influential in using kids and sending them. And that's how Stompy found out that he himself was an informant. Fearing this, then he ended his life.
Taking note of what Isaac has just told us, how do you guys feel about that? Do you feel like they've done justice to her legacy? Is she truly represented and held in the same regard as Isaac is depicting her right now? Because I'm sure that based alone on that New York Times article, that headline, that must have got people talking, as we now know that Black Twitter was ablaze. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I think she did do some justice to her legacy. At least we've got people like Pravin Gordhan, Trevor Manuel, Tokyo Sihwan, all these so-called white establishment folks coming out and defending her legacy. In fact, you know, even Judge Simsinak and George Bezos, I mean, they came out from the legal fraternity to say, no, Winnie was no sellout, and anyone saying that Winnie was useless or try to infer that she sold out or something, that wasn't true.
The skepticism that gathers people's thoughts on Winnie was around just Stompy's killing. But during the time, the UDF, all these people that you talk about, they all distanced themselves against Winnie at the time. Only for them now, after democracy, after she went through the humiliation of the TRC, for her to be branded some hero.
But we know that's for political capital.
For what interests? Because they've been such vocal critics of the Zuma administration, have made themselves the faces of this South Africa in transition, you know? It would be very worrisome if people like Pravin Gordhan and Trevor Manuel would come out and bash Winnie like Mbeki is perceived to have done.
I think we should actually hear that.
And the rule was that if ministers, deputy ministers have got to travel out of the country, they need to clear that with the president. At least the president must know. And so notice was sent, I can't remember, she was, I think, to the United States or somewhere. And the president said no. Nevertheless, she went. In defiance. So of course, when she comes back, the president says, in which case, it's not possible to govern. And therefore, please leave.
So we have an incident where in a government, and don't get me wrong, I'm sure if we go through the archives, we'll have similar incidents of other people doing something similar. Here we are told that Winnie defied Mandela by going on a plane to the United States of America. For that, it was a dismissible offense. Considering that we've just transitioned into a democratic South Africa, this is a liberation hero in in many respects. Not that I'm saying that grants her any privileges as such, but she's a cadre nonetheless. She's served and she's part of this new government. Clearly she's earned her spot to be in this government if Mandela saw it fit to put her there. Unless Mandela, of course, was then subjected to pressures that he couldn't actually handle. So I want to know what you guys think about that. The fact that here we have a woman who got dismissed for an offense that I'm sure several other men did, but they weren't dismissed for.
Not sure about that one, because I don't know who's this man that went outside of the country without the permission of the president and still made it back as minister, you know? If you want to say that the president who you serve at their pleasure instructs you as a deputy minister in their cabinet to not go to a particular country or leave the country at that time and you fail to cede to that, that's an offense, because then that's insubordination.
I think it was because people would think that she's taking privileges because she was the ex-wife of Nelson Mandela, you understand?
Here to make a statement.
But even that, but you hear Mbeki say that most of the time Mandela was out on diplomatic duties abroad, and all of that was left to him.
Then we have a second incident where she wants to go for the position of deputy president within the ANC. She basically wants to get nomination from the floor at the Mafikeng conference. That opportunity was closed down by Thabo Mbeki.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
Right? True. And under the guise that it was not within the rules of the organization. Then there was another incident where he claims that she used to enjoy coming late to events. That's how he describes it. It was fun for her. He was disgusted at this point in time, and as he puts it, he gestured and somehow hit her head and it fell down,
you know,
because he was reprimanding her. But essentially, many saw that as a slap at the time. But he says there's no apology needed for that. All I'm saying is that there seems to be a series of events where he seems to be talking about Winnie in quite a negative way to justify why there is such an ambivalence towards her.
It just makes me think that black men are always trying to bring black women down a peg or two, and this is classic of that. I also feel that like a microscopic lens is always put on black women, and I just feel like it's the same kind of situation that we see here.
Let's move on to the next story.
Education and racism within education has made the headlines this week. It started from an incident a few weeks ago that has been carried on, basically. Rafaru Chisango was in her dorm room and two students were shouting racial slurs at her at Nottingham Trent University. Those students were detained. I think they were arrested. But since then, more students have come forward citing that racist incidents within universities are widespread. Some examples of these is Punish a Muslim Day, which was at the beginning of April, where people were beating up Muslim people, attacking them, harassing them. Absolutely disgusting behavior. Yep. And also an incident involving the University of Exeter, where there was a WhatsApp group in a law society that was spreading racial slurs, being racist. A whole debate has followed. Students come forward saying that universities are not safe spaces. And an MP committee comes forward saying that unis should not be safe spaces. I think that was made by Harriet Harman. She said, people in universities should have freedom of speech. Well, there was an article published and it said that students should avoid offensive conversations or conversations that they felt were offensive. So now students from Exeter are demanding that UK universities should take action against racism. However, it's also been accused that the universities just care about PR rather than actually tackling racism.
This Islamophobia It seems like England is still grappling with this whole binary thinking of what they termed Orientals back in the day. It still seems to be a growing problem, and I'm assuming the war, quote unquote, on terror is not helping much.
Yeah, to be honest, that's the whole reason. Basically, when Middle Eastern countries do not cooperate with the West just fight back with bombs and with guns and ammunition. So that's what we're finding. And this idea that, you know, people that are Muslim are less than, it's basically propaganda, so that when we do go to war with the Middle East, those people are dehumanized. So, you know, there is no great uproar. So this Islamophobia is something that we see in our newspapers, the Daily Mail, various newspapers just love to talk about how awful Muslims are and just absolutely disgusting rhetoric. No wonder Punish a Muslim Day was trending on Twitter. No wonder.
To have hashtag Punish Muslim Day, it was a norm.
It's a norm for some people within Britain, yeah. What's shocking to me is that I did hear about Punish a Muslim Day, but I never thought that people would actually go out doing it. However, there's been reports where, you know, a young man was at a gym, I believe, and he was attacked by a group of people. He was badly beaten up. There's been reports that have said that there have been people that have been targeted.
And people of colour in England, how do they treat the Muslim people generally?
I feel like in general, it's kind of a situation where people like to keep to themselves, I would say. I feel like there is some kind of kinship, but in general, there is anti-blackness in all cultures. So there is that issue.
We can't deny though that in some quarters, among the reasons that people say why they are uncomfortable, to use that awful term, with Muslim people, they do attribute economic factors, do they not? They take our jobs, they are taking up
it's interesting coming from a place like Britain complaining about people taking their jobs, because those are the same nations that exploit whole countries into slave-like labor. So it's always that when people share that stance over here, especially coming from a white person, it's very, I find it just very hypocritical and ignorant to say that, you know, this is a country that is benefiting from the exploitation of people of color. And so when a few of us decide to migrate, then all of a sudden it's a huge problem when you're still benefiting from our slavery.
The answer would be no, we are enemies, because we are in war with your country.
Tell us about the African, I'm assuming these are African students that are studying in the UK that are victims of racism. I'm assuming so. Can you give us a little bit more context into the black students that are victims of this racism, and maybe then Ayana can give us her perspective on that.
Okay, so the comment, it was a WhatsApp group. The incident in Exeter,
sure.
It was the WhatsApp group. So there were messages posted like, if you ain't English, go home, bomb the mosques, we need a race law. And this was shared in a Law Society WhatsApp group. So clearly these are students that have joined the group and they're just sharing racial hatred. And the fact that these students and not being reprimanded in the way that many people would expect a university to reprimand such an incident brought a lot of heat towards Exeter University.
I don't know, what do you make of that in light of the fact that there's a debate around whether universities should be safe spaces or not?
We need to be more direct in our language. It's not whether or not a university should be a safe space. What we need to start talking about is, will people of color be protected from white hatred. Like, that's what this is really about, because this whole conversation about safe space is too vague for me. I want specific, direct change. I want to know if people of color will be protected from these white folks who are, like, being openly hateful. You know what I'm saying? Also, white media is never going to report this in the way that inspires and motivates their readers to speak out against it. That's the problem with white media. It's never going to be truthful in its reporting about these things. You know, the way they demonize black folks in the media, they're never going to demonize the white people being hateful. They're never going to be honest about it. So it's never going to motivate the readers to get angry enough to speak out against Parliament or whoever. So I'm just over it.
But I like the fact that you highlight that, because not only is it vague, but in its vagueness, when I hear that, I infer that, you know, they're trying to make it sound like we as black folk are crying out for some white lily haven where white folk will have these grins on their faces telling us, oh, how are you doing today, kind of thing, fake grins and all of that. And that is not what's necessary here, as you rightly pointed out.
And I thought in the first world things work a little bit differently, man. You know, I thought because it's the first world and people understand, well, they understand notions of democracy, liberalism, that would be more tolerant in a space like university. I mean, these are the people that will ultimately inherit the world.
But I feel like that's the whole point. Through this incident, what we're seeing is that MPs, newspapers are saying it's okay to be racist, it's okay to not protect the vulnerable people amongst you, it's okay to be, to have patriarchal views, it's okay to be ableist, it's okay to have all these unacceptable opinions and to say them as you like, as you feel, and we are going to protect you from any backlash that you're going to receive from that.
I think it's a bit naive of ICE to think that a country that plundered the world, well, various parts of the world at least, let's be fair, right?
I mean, yeah, they're savages. You know? What else do you expect?
I mean, they plundered the world. They go around killing people, massacring, destroying societies. Yeah. And next thing, you expect them to be humble?
No, let me clear that up. Like, being in places like debate and things like that, we often have students that will do their post-grad at Oxford, and they come back and they tell us wonderful things about those spaces that they say they achieved some, you know.
The very same university that wouldn't remove Cecil John Rhodes' statue.
Some of them would tell you that they had a great experience, you know.
Are you saying this mockingly to point out the hypocrisy of these institutions? Because that's the only way I see that makes sense.
What's happening in Israel?
So Israel has been making the headlines in the past week. Israel released a statement saying that Ethiopian, Eritrean, and Sudanese refugees were to be resettled in the West. However, countries came forward like Italy and Germany, and they refuted this. They said that they never agreed to this. It's also been reported that African migrants in Israel were forced to leave their children in unsafe childminding situations. Previously, it's also been stated that Israel had even threatened African migrants with imprisonment. There was a lot of confusion over this, and eventually, I think midweek, the Israel Prime Minister flip-flopped and went back on what they said about African migrant resettlement. So there was a lot of confusion here as to what exactly was meant to be happening with the resettlement of African migrants.
And then in the backdrop of this, we have Israeli snipers shooting at the Palestinians, and
exactly.
And then we have the great DJ Black Coffee, note the irony,
exactly.
Well, sarcasm rather, going there to go perform.
Israel dispatched 100 snipers to open fire into a crowd of unarmed protesters last weekend. Israel was warned by the UN about the Gaza protests happening next week, and it was also accused of breaking international law by the shoot-to-kill policy. So Black Coffee performed in Israel recently, and he received huge backlash from Black Twitter. Apparently, he was sent multiple letters urging him not to play there. But in a statement, he said that, like everyone else, I have rights and free will. And no, Black Coffee is not a political party. I work as an entertainer to feed my family. To sum it up, I'll take a bullet for my family.
Coffee.
Still a real nigga shit.
Yo. All right.
Now, my understanding, at least, is that Black Coffee goes to Israel, and this is that week already the snipers are shooting at the Palestinians, right? The issue about the African migrants. It seemed like he was just oblivious to this. Was he? Was he not? What are your guys' thoughts?
Huh, please, y'all thought a Black man was gonna take the lead and like do the right thing and make a political statement when it's something for him to gain? Please, I wouldn't. He's a man. He's a man. Like, of course he was gonna do what he wanted to do to get his money. Talking about feed his family. He didn't care about feeding his family. He just wanted to make his coin. He didn't care about the African migrants and he ignored Black Twitter's pleas for him to do the right thing and stand with us and here. And, you know, let it have been a Black woman, she would have did the right thing. But no. You know, always count on the Black man to serve himself.
But what about the fact that Black Coffee's got a disability, though? You know, the fact that he really didn't actually have a choice. I mean, we already know that people with disabilities are at the fringes in terms of getting job opportunities. You know, they usually,
yeah, but
sorry
to interject there, but if you look at Black Coffee doesn't identify as a person that's disabled. Yes, he has.
It doesn't matter. That's regardless of how he identifies, though. But the point is, he's not like the rest of us below the poverty line. I mean, he's making money. If he could have made his money doing something else, I'm not going to let him off the hook because of his disability.
Yeah, I agree with that. I feel like on a PR angle, if he had a proper representative, they would have advised him not to do that, because in the long run, he probably would have lost money because he would have lost support.
People aren't taking in consideration, like, he's been there for the past 3 years, man, and it's never been an issue for us or for Black Twitter, because those are the people that mostly took fault with Black Coffee. It's sort of like he's in support of the apartheid that's happening in Israel.
But guys, what about the African migrants there? You know,
that's what I'm saying. In Glangla, that's what I'm saying.
He should be cognizant of the fact that the African people there who are under siege.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Sure,
but though, guys, this his statement says clearly, I'm not a political party.
Mm.
Of course he would say that. That is the most self-serving thing. I'm not even surprised.
It reminds me of what Little Wayne said about...
Yes, thank you, Nklangla. Yo, can I remember what he said. He said something like, my Black life matter to my bitches, and that's all that matters to me. I don't know what Black lives matter means. They never care about us.
Fuck, guys.
Sure. No, fair enough point. I mean, and
celebrities are disgusting. And they're horrible people.
So, people published an article recently entitled CEO of Planned Parenthood claims that Ivanka Trump's husband Jared Kushner bribed her to have Planned Parenthood stop providing abortions. So she said she took the meeting to have Planned Parenthood
stop providing abortions. So she said she took the meeting. She didn't know if it was a good idea. This whole meeting happened back in 2016, well, right after the election, right when Trump was the president-elect. One of Trump's biggest things, you know, during his campaign was to defund Planned Parenthood and Obamacare. She knew that having a meeting with him wouldn't have worked, you know, they wouldn't have gotten anywhere. So she was like, well, maybe we can appeal to what she described as some of the more moderate folks in his cabinet. I guess that would be his daughter and Jared Kushner. So she took the meeting, and in the meeting, Jared Kushner says, well, we can really back Planned Parenthood, and we can really provide some funding on the condition that you stop providing abortions. This is definitely an attack on Black women. It is, by all means, an attack on Black women. In New York City alone, Black women are 12 times more likely to die than white women due to maternal mortality rates. And in New York, like, abortion is legal under the conditions of before 24 weeks and only after if it's life-threatening. They don't see a non-viable fetus as a life-threatening circumstance, so they make you carry that fetus to term. So you got to carry it to term knowing that your baby's going to die when it's born.
What's your take on this as a fellow female?
I just feel like it's kind of expected, which is really sad. I kind of feel like it's disappointing news, but it's expected. Of course, what was her name? Ivanka?
Ivanka Trump.
Of course she would allow this kind of very misogynistic policy in order to protect the patriarchy instead of using her power to help women just like her. Of course she wouldn't care about Black women or women that are more vulnerable because of race, because of ability, because of any other factor.
Listen, women's reproductive rights are under attack under this Trump administration. They don't really care. They just want to control women's bodies, yeah. And especially Black women's bodies. Historically, this world has been trying to control women's bodies. They've been withholding our medical records, using us as medical experiments. They are trying to control us. And when they want us to have abortions, they try to control us some more. When they want to stop it, they try to control us some more. We are literally under attack.
Blanca, I read in USA Today that Ivanka Trump was doing this so that she could buy favor with her daddy, so that daddy right. could take her seriously. Blanca, what do you make of it?
I mean, I don't know. It sounds sexist, you know? You know, why is it because she's trying
or to... that she's got her own biases.
It's like she cannot think for herself. She
needs daddy to think for
her. Yeah, I mean, what's her views? It's like her views are being suppressed. So maybe what they're trying to say is that she's got other views, in fact. She's being coerced into saying this.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it's not of her own free volition to say that, you know?
To say this.
But what I would add to that is that she is a politician. She's not meant to be thinking about her own personal views. She's meant to be thinking about womankind, everybody yes. with a vagina in her country, and what's going to be best for those women, not just because, oh, I have this view on what I want to do with my body, and so I'm going to enforce that on every single person in the country.
Your final remark?
But then we shouldn't view the whole reproductive thing as being purely a measure to take away reproductive rights from women alone, you know? Because, I mean, pregnancies, I mean, it's not a one-way thing, you know? It's a two-way thing. We men, we should have a say as well, you know, whether we want the baby.
No,
or
you
not.
Shouldn't. You don't know. You don't get a say in nothing.
No, I think we do. I think we do. You know, for the mere fact we engage in the intercourse, right? Right.
Well, first of all,
it takes a woman.
Okay, wait. I'm just gonna allow one comment from each person. Yeah, and then finish your point.
What would happen is black men are also going to be affected by this. If I was in the position that I had a woman and she's pregnant and you don't want the child, but she's not allowed to do the abortion, where does that leave me then?
Firstly, I'd like to say that the whole reproductive issue and the rights of men and women within it need more nuance. Men at large don't like to wear condoms. The amount of men that I've been with that refused to wear condoms and said, oh baby, I'm just going to pull out instead. Second of all, men are unwilling to buy the morning after pill. Thirdly, the pill for men was actually being tested and the men involved said, oh no, the side effects are too bad, I don't like it. So it never worked. So if men really cared about reproductive rights, then they would be more involved in ensuring that their sperm isn't leaking everywhere, impregnating every single body, and they would keep that shit for themselves.
Bars.
But they don't. They like spray it everywhere.
Ayana.
Stop spraying, men. Stop spraying.
Ayana. Yeah.
My closing remarks is men need to stop centering themselves in the reproductive rights conversation, especially cisgender men. This has absolutely nothing to do with you. Nothing. This is not your issue. Cisgender men are dying as a result of pregnancy. They are not. So you do not get a say in our reproductive health. That is my final remark.
He's no stranger to the courtroom, and South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma, is due back at the dock to face charges it was cleared off more than a decade ago.
The decision taken by the National Prosecuting Authority during or about 28 December 2007 to prosecute the applicant, a copy of which is annexed to the applicant's founding affidavit as Annexure A thereto, is invalid and is set aside.
The National Prosecuting Authority says Zuma is facing 16 charges of fraud and corruption. He is accused of taking bribes from a French military contractor in the late 1990s in an arms deal worth $2.5 billion at the time.
That there are reasonable prospects of a successful prosecution of Mr. Zuma on the charges listed in the indictment.
The scandal led to his dismissal as deputy president in 2005, but didn't rob his chances of becoming president 4 years later. Zuma denies all the charges, but throughout his presidency, he remained embroiled in accusations of corruption, from spending taxpayers' money to upgrade his private home in Nkandla to receiving money from the wealthy South African Gupta family in exchange for political favors.
Oh, Hinde.
Jacob Zuma, what's happening? The stories that I followed was one news bulletin that was pushed by the BBC, in which BBC describes Zuma's conduct to buy arms in a poverty-stricken society as one of the worst crimes that has happened in South Africa in its history. That same line was followed by Huffington Post, Andrew Finstein, one of the biggest critics of the arms deal, former ANC MP, said that the arms deal was the point in which the ANC lost its moral compass. The arms deal signifies the ANC's fall from grace within the system, because at that time that the ANC knew about the corruption that Zuma had committed, and he, as the former MP then, informed the ANC, but the ANC failed to take action. In fact, they removed Feinstein. He has always been at the forefront of civil society organizations that have played a role in demoralizing Zuma and painting him as this one prick. Here's what Zuma says. Zuma says that what's wrong with South Africa is not in fact him or the ANC having signed the arms deal. Zuma says the problem with South Africa is its untransformed nature, especially in regards to the economy, that the economy remains largely apartheid era style. The same economic forces at the helm during apartheid are the same forces now in the Democratic Republic of South Africa. And then these same forces are the forces that have fought the ANC.
Okay. My question to you is that in light of what Nandla is telling us, mainstream media is quite clear on this point, and they always make this righteous point that in a democratic society, we have supposedly moved away from apartheid. But in a democratic society, is it right for us to just disregard these charges? Aren't we supposed to be at least showing society that we do hold those in authority accountable? And these are new beginnings. If Zuma is guilty of these charges, then let him pay the price. What are your thoughts on that? That it is a moral decision to actually continue with this and not necessarily these aspersions that some black people are sprouting, saying that it's anti-black and all of that.
In terms of it being this anti-black type of rhetoric, that there's these white forces that are out to get Zuma, I've seen it unfold, right? This was clearly after he had just been removed from office. And a few months ago, they were saying that the Gupta should be trialed for the same nefarious dealings they had with Zuma in parliament. But the same standard isn't met now that we're preaching about this new dawn where we are purging out corruption in our democracy, right? But even if that were the case, I don't think this person should be ridiculed by his party, because there were other members within his party that benefited from the arms deal. The ANC itself.
They
benefited from the arms deal, but we don't hear about other members of the ANC being brought to book.
Considering the fact that news accounts overseas often depict African leaders as corrupt, as backward thinking, as these villains of society, how do you feel hearing about this particular case in light of what Ndlantla has been saying, or what's been said thus far anyway?
So the other people involved in the arms deal, who were they, all black?
No, they were not all black. The main companies that we contracted from were a French, a Sweden, and British companies, but then largely there were subsidies of French companies.
What I'm interested in knowing is, in your opinion, how much do you think that the ANC are towing a black respectability line? How much are the ANC trying to be the good black people, the respectable, non-violent, white supremacist pet?
Essentially, to what extent are they being like Mandela's government?
They are Mandela's government from 94, as I said before, because we've already taken some concessions, some social concessions regarding the economy, leaving it unchanged since apartheid. But then the position that ANC has taken was one in which we said that we need a national revolution where the demographics of the society are reflected in the economic ownership patterns. Under Zuma, the ANC had established controversial policy which whites don't necessarily agree with, that land has to be expropriated without compensation, and that free education is a must. And this was announced by Zuma.
With that, I want to just give Isaac the final word.
All right, in terms of like the makeup of the ANC, people need to understand that there are factions always that rise every 10 years with the ANC. So we started with Mandela's peaceful ANC, and then it was Mbeki's even worse off super pro-West. And it was Zuma that moved us towards seeking investments from the East, starting BRICS, and having our own development bank. Those were plans that he was trying to achieve. Right now, we are sort of back to a pro-West faction with Cyril. These were members of the UDF. If you had followed my analysis on the UDF during apartheid, especially with the Winnie story, you'd understand they have very pro-West leanings, and thus they are seen as the people that can rescue the ANC right now.
With that, we've come to the end of the first edition of The Thinking Behind It All. Thank you to the crew, Nhlanhla, Ayana, Sage Cole, and Isaac for their contributions. Thank you to our extraordinary sound engineer slash producer for putting the project together. And more importantly, thank you to all the people that downloaded the podcast and listened to us. We really appreciate your support. Please remember that you can drop us a comment, tell us how much we suck, or how much love you have for us on our Facebook page, The Thinking Behind It All. Or you can follow us on Twitter at TTBIA_. And as we say, Lala Gahle to Umam Wini. We conclude the show by commemorating other fallen heroes, Solomon Mahlangu, Dr. Martin Luther King, and Maya Angelou. It is also a significant week, for in 1652, the 6th of April, Jan van Riebeeck landed in the Cape, an event that has altered the lives of South Africans from all walks of life.
Yeah.